From KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. People have hallucinations for all kinds of different reasons. And when they happen, they can be weird and scary. You see a zigzagging light or a strange face or tiny people. The neuroscientist Oliver Sacks says not all cultures are freaked out about hallucinations. In some places, they're thought of as a special state of consciousness. In the West, he says, though, we mostly see them as a symptom of madness or the result of disease. Sacks is trying to strip away some of that stigma. He calls his new book a sort of natural history of hallucinations. Today in the program, he'll join us to explain how they work, the forms they take, and what they tell us about the increasingly fascinating human brain. Hallucinations, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the acclaimed writer and neurologist Oliver Sacks is joining us. His latest book is about hallucinations, zigzagging light or strange faces and figures or voices. The sense of a phantom limb is a hallucination, and they can be terrifying monsters or beautiful blobs of intense color. But it's important to note these aren't dreams or fantasies. Dr. Sacks says a hallucination is a unique and special category of consciousness and mental life. Today in the program, he's joining us to talk about his book. It's called Hallucinations. We invite you to join the conversation if you have questions or comments. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from those of you on Facebook or Twitter. Oliver Sacks is a physician, a professor of neurology at New York University School of Medicine, the author of a number of books, among them The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat and Musicophilia. He's joining us today from a studio in New York City. And Oliver Sacks, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Nice to be with you.
You've said that you've been interested in hallucinations all of your life. Why is that, do you think?
Well, I think it's partly that as a child, I would get attacks of visual migraine in which one can see strange geometrical shapes and other things. Also, as a child, of course, I read A Christmas Carol and other Dickens books in Great Expectations. There's a hallucination of Miss Havisham. Yeah. And then when I became a doctor, I saw so many patients with different disorders who had hallucinations of one sort and another. I'd written a little about them in previous books, but I thought it would be time and fun to bring them all together in one book, especially now very good in the brain while people are actually having hallucinations.
Dr. Sacks, I'm going to interrupt you for just a moment. Forgive me. We're having some sort of technical problem. I'm sure people can hear that. So I'm going to take a quick break. Forgive me. Oliver Sacks is with us. His book is called Hallucinations. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Oliver Sacks is with us. We're talking about his book, Hallucinations, joining us from a studio in New York City. I think we have you back. Dr. Sacks, sorry about that. Are you with us?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Okay, sorry. I want to ask about how our perceptions of hallucinations have changed over the course of time, because you write in the book that we didn't always think of hallucinations as scary things, as secretive things. How has it changed over time?
Well, I think in the 18th century, for example, and before that, people heard voices and had visions and often discussed them fairly openly. these were usually regarded as having some spiritual origin, either from gods or demons, or from the muses, or from ancestors, or spirits of the dead, whatever. But it was this was part of the culture and fairly openly discussed. In the around 1820, 1830, hallucinations became was given a medical meaning,
right.
And in particular as a symptom of schizophrenia, or sometimes of dementia. And I think it's continued to have that rather ominous connotation both in the medical and the public mind, and a very unjustified connotation.
Yeah. So you say that part of what you're trying to do in the book is sort of strip away that stigma.
Yes, exactly. And partly by giving examples and many examples of hallucinations which people had been fearful about and fearful to mention, but which once they did mention could be discussed and seen as really as benign and as something one could live with and conceivably even enjoy.
What is a hallucination? I mean, I mentioned in the introduction the point you make that we shouldn't confuse this with dreams or fantasies, that it's right. a special category.
Well, one of the old names for hallucination was apparition. And I think that gives a sense, a stronger sense of the sudden appearance of an object or a person in front of one, or maybe a sudden noise or a sudden smell, which seems intensely real and to come from outside, but nobody else confirms it. Unlike imagination, unlike even a vivid image, this is located in the external world, is extremely detailed, usually much more detailed than any mental image, and it seems very real, and one has to struggle to understand it.
Let's talk about a patient you encountered a few years ago. You write about this in the book, a woman named Rosa Lee, or you call her Rosa Lee in the book. I mean, she'd been having these hallucinations, which seemed, as you say in the book, overwhelmingly real. And one of the things that makes the story interesting, I think, is that Rosa Lee was completely blind and had been for years, and yet she was telling her nurses that she was seeing things right in front of her. Talk about this case.
Yeah, well, the nurses wondered if she was insane or if she was losing her mind or had had a stroke or was ill, and they called me in. They were especially puzzled because Rosalie was blind. And when I spoke to Rosalie, she said she'd seen nothing for 5 years and suddenly she was seeing things. And I said, what sort of things? And she gave me a vivid description that she'd seen people in Eastern dress, as she said, walking in front of her. She'd seen various animals which might come towards her, then stop at a certain distance. She'd seen a horse. She'd seen a snowplow. She'd seen children playing. And I said, are these like dreams? And she said, no, I'm awake. I'm conscious. She said they're like little films or film strips, and sometimes they repeat themselves. She said they're completely silent. Even if I see people's lips move, I can't hear any speech. And I examined her. She was in her 90s, but she was highly intelligent, very sane and solid as a person. I couldn't find any neurological abnormality. I didn't find any mix of medications which might be upsetting her. But I did find her eyes, her retina, almost destroyed by disease, by macular degeneration. And I said to her, I think I know what's going on. I said, some blind people or people with impaired vision can get hallucinations just like this. And this is really because the brain likes to work and to process information all the while, and if it's not getting any information from the outside, then it will draw on memory and imagination and jumble things up and give you hallucinations from the inside. And I said, this will probably settle, and you can get used to it. The hallucinations can't harm you, and they're nothing to worry about. Yeah. And I said, these have been described in the 18th century by a man called Charles Bonnet, and we speak of Charles Bonnet syndrome.
Right.
And she was very reassured by all of this, and especially and rather tickled that what she had might have a name. And she said, tell the nurses that I have Charles Bonnet syndrome.
Right.
And then she said, who was Charles Bonnet? Did he have it himself? And so I work in many old age homes, and I see numbers of old people who are perfectly intact mentally and sane, but who have impaired vision or hearing. And the visually impaired ones tend to get visual hallucinations, or may get them, like Rosalie. Mm. And the ones with poor hearing tend to get auditory and especially musical hallucinations.
You know, the hallucinations you write about of people who see under this condition, Charles Bonnet syndrome, text, musical scores are interesting because they seem very real, but they're not readable, you say. They have no shape or no tune or grammar or syntax.
It's quite common. Something like a quarter of the people with Charles Bonnet syndrome see letters, words, pseudo words, sentences which don't make sense, or musical notation which at first looks like extremely elaborate modern music, like Schoenberg or something, with all the notes inflected, but then it's then seen to be almost too ornamented, has too many sharps and flats and too many notes to be sung or played. So here one is not having memories as such coming up, but memory is being mined, so to speak, but the results jumbled up. And it may be similar with faces. One may see, often in rapid flickering succession, hundreds of different faces, all strongly delineated and characteristic and non-recognizable. Mm. I think this is one, among other things, I think it shows the astounding sort of computational power or inventiveness of the visual brain, that it can make a million plausible faces, none of which actually occur.
You say that people with these kinds of hallucinations lose their primary visual world, but they gain a secondary visual world.
In a sense, they may come to like this or accept it. I quote one man who imagines his eyes saying to him, "We know blindness is no fun, so we've arranged this small syndrome as a sort of coda to your sighted life. It's not much, but it's the best we can do." I think that was very charming and an example of, you know, the acceptance. For some people, like one poet I mentioned, the hallucinations may in fact stimulate the creative imagination.
This is Virginia Hamilton Adair. You say she really was inspired by those hallucinations.
Yes, she'd been a fine poetess when she was young, and then her poetic voice seemed to desert her. But she came back in old age, published her first book of poetry when she was 83, and I was sent this by her, as well as some wonderful on-the-spot dictations. And she would have a tape recorder on her lap and just describe what was going on. Mm. And one could see how rich the hallucinations were, and also, in a way, how different from imagination.
You know, you ask these questions early in the book about whether or not geometric patterns, for example, that are seen in hallucinations that are associated with migraines, if they in some way are the motifs that we see in Native American or Aboriginal art, or whether these hallucinations that some people have, where they see little tiny people, which tend to be common hallucinations, whether or not that is where we got elves and the idea of leprechauns and those kinds of things. I guess we don't know, but it seems like hallucinations could have played a really powerful role in our culture.
Well, I couldn't help wondering that, and say the geometrical patterns or the Lilliputian hallucinations are not uncommon. And beside migraine, you can have them in fever or just before you fall asleep. In a whole variety of situations, if one is somewhat sleep-deprived, one may have things like this.
You write about the visual distortions that come to some people with migraines. One particular story of a person who had an experience where she saw this tiny little man and his ox. Two questions there. Are these Lilliputian things, I guess they're common images that people see?
Well, they're not uncommon.
Yeah.
There's a beautiful description of this by Siri Husted, the novelist, and how she looked tenderly at the little man and ox, and then they suddenly disappeared about 10 minutes later, like the rest of the visual migraine.
So are they provoked by trauma, by pain?
No, I think sometimes one has a thing called the migraine aura,
yeah,
in which you have visual symptoms, occasionally auditory symptoms, before the headache and the vomiting, etc. And if you're lucky, you may just get the aura and nothing bad to follow, which has been my own experience, yeah, since childhood.
It's interesting how experiences like grief, though, can create hallucinations.
Well, very, very important and common that after a dearly beloved husband or wife or parent or sib dies, there is a pretty good likelihood, not only of illusions that you sometimes think you see them in the street, but it turns out to be someone else, but of actual hallucinations of seeing their face, hearing their voice. And these hallucinations are often felt to be comforting, and as it were, and may play an important part in the mourning process. It's almost as if the hole which a death leaves in one's life gets filled while one is accommodating. It gets filled by these hallucinations, and this is said to happen in as many as a third of married couples, especially if it's been a long and happy marriage. Mm.
Is this some version of a phantom limb, you know, a phantom person?
In general sort of disappearance, whether it's deprivation of vision or hearing or a limb or a beloved person, tends to produce things. I think the phantom limb is very special. We might talk about it later.
No, we will. We'll come back to it.
But here, I think it's just the, you know, someone whom one's lived with for 50 years and loves, you know, so much of one's mind and one's brain, you know, has been occupied by them. And then, as it were, that now unoccupied area will maybe invite hallucinations and dreams.
I want to ask about auditory hallucinations, because you've had this experience yourself when you had a sort of traumatic experience while mountain climbing. You'd become seriously injured, you heard a voice, and it wasn't your own voice, telling you to keep going, don't fall asleep, don't stop.
Yeah. This occurred. I had a badly injured leg, and I was alone, and no one knew where I was. And at one point, I was, I think, in a state close to shock, and I felt it wouldn't have been nice to rest. And this voice told me, sort of, no way, get going, find a pace you can keep up. It seemed, I don't know whether to say it seemed external, but it was certainly not the usual muttering which I have inside, which said, you know, you fool, where have you put your glasses?
Right.
But this was a clear, incisive voice which asked to be obeyed, which demanded to be obeyed. And I think it was sort of life-saving. And this may happen in other circumstances. I mentioned the case of one young woman who was heartbroken after a love affair went wrong and had a bottle of sleeping tablets and a tumbler of whiskey ready to commit suicide. And just as she was about to take them, a voice said, "Don't do that. I wouldn't do that. You won't always be feeling as you're feeling now." So I think in extreme situations, hallucinations can come to one's aid. Mm. They may seem to be external, although if one is a rational person, well, one finds that, in fact, there is no one around and that, therefore, this must come from some part of yourself.
Mm. You know, we did a show a week ago or so about ghost stories, uh-huh. and it made me wonder, reading your book, can we explain people who say they see ghosts or hear ghosts as having had a hallucination, do you think?
Well, I think so. One is in a state of high expectancy if one goes into a haunted house. You know, even if you say, "I don't believe in ghosts," then nonetheless you're sort of hyper-tuned for anything unusual. And I think that ghosts are forms of hallucination. When Scrooge sees Marley's ghost in A Christmas Carol, this is described as semi-transparent. One can see the furniture through it. But one of my patients who has Charles-Bonnet syndrome would describe some of his hallucinatory figures as disappearing under the door, becoming a sort of vapor, and that made him think of a ghost. I think ghosts are hallucinations, sometimes benign, sometimes malignant, maybe especially hallucinations of the dead, or hallucinations of, well, I think ghostly hallucinations may be especially common with guilt. So, say, Macbeth sees Banquo's ghost, and Lady Macbeth sees ghostly blood on her fingers.
Yeah. And a dagger.
And the dagger.
Yeah. I have to say, it's interesting how much attention, Oliver Sacks, you've gotten for the chapter in your book where you write about your own personal experiences with hallucinogenic drugs. It often seems to be the first thing that comes up, I have to say. And I wonder, does that bother you at all?
Yes, somewhat. I have to say this was, although it may be the first thing which comes up, for me it was the last thing which came
right.
up. And the last thing put in the book and put in with some hesitation, but also a feeling that I should put it in because one can only know about these things from first-person experiences, and here I was the first person. I am the first person.
Yeah.
And it was quite a time ago, more than 40 years ago, so I can distance myself somewhat.
And you can put yourself in the same place as William James, for example, you write about. He was very interested in the mystical powers of intoxicants, you say.
Yes, and he tried several of them, including nitrous oxide, and he felt that for him this uncovered many different forms of consciousness, layers of consciousness, unlike rational consciousness. And he thought layers of consciousness of which we are too unaware, and layers of consciousness which may be valuable, may be terrifying.
You know, made me have this, raise this question for me, I think, about whether or not some of us are more inclined to hallucinations for various reasons. And I wanted to ask you about something. You write about this experience in 1965 when you had moved to New York to do some postgraduate work. And you write about how that at the time you were having a hard time sleeping, and so you were taking chloral hydrate to get to sleep. You were taking a lot of it. And then after at some point you stopped taking it, and you had this experience one day where you were having lunch And you started to have these hallucinations, really terrifying hallucinations. We tell that story, if you will.
Yeah. I was drinking coffee and it suddenly turned green and then purple. And there was a man at the cash register in the restaurant, and he suddenly developed a huge upper body like a sea elephant with a huge proboscis. And I sort of panicked and ran across the road, got onto a bus. But all the passengers seemed to have huge egg-shaped heads with insect-like eyes, which move suddenly. And I realized that I was in the grip of an almost uncontrollable hallucinosis. I had my notebook with me, as I always have, and I really held on by writing down and describing what I saw. Writing for me is a very essential part of life to clarify and organize. Somehow or other, I got back to my apartment, although by the time I got off the bus, buildings were waving like flags in a high wind. I phoned a friend of mine. We'd interned together and said, "Carol, I have to say goodbye. I'm going mad." And she said, "Oliver, what have you just taken?" And I said, "I haven't taken anything." And she thought for a moment and she said, "Well, what have you just stopped taking?" And I said, "Ah, that's it, the chloral hydrate." And she said, "Well, Oliver, you've got a classical case of the DTs, yeah. Delirium tremens, and I will be over in a few minutes." And she came over. I was hugely relieved that it was merely delirium tremens, although delirium tremens can be very dangerous and even fatal, and not a schizophrenic psychosis, really, because I had a schizophrenic brother, and I saw how tormented he was for years by hallucinations. Incidentally, I hardly speak about schizophrenic hallucinations in the book. I feel they demand another book.
Yeah.
A book because the subject is much more complex. I would have advised anyone else to go to an emergency room, but I thought I would like to tough it out and experience it. And Carol sat with me and kept tabs on me. And so that was quite an interesting experience, although not one which I had voluntarily induced. And it went on much too long.
Well, you know, that was the takeaway for me, was how writing gave you so much, was the way you kind of dealt with that. And that's the way in your life you've dealt with complex or frightening situations.
Yeah, with all sorts of things. I've had a lot of surgery recently with a replaced knee and a broken hip and some spinal problems. And I was in intense pain before and after the spinal surgery. And I was given all sorts of pain pills, but I actually found that writing was better than morphine. And I know morphine. One of the hallucinations I described came from injecting morphine.
Yeah.
But I think it's wonderful how in writing, or sometimes in listening to music, you can rise above your present condition, get into another realm, and hold together.
You know, there's a lovely story about, and I won't spend the rest of the time, I promise, talking about your own experiences with all of this. But there is a story where you talk about when you were taking amphetamines on the weekend after work, but you had one weekend you had taken amphetamines and you took this very old book about migraines out of the library, and you write about how you had really became just enthralled, overtaken by it. It seemed like you were writing the book yourself, you say.
And it seemed to me a very, very, very beautiful book. It was a book from the 1860s, and I thought, well, it's the 1960s now. We need a book like this, but who'd write it? And there was a very loud internal voice which said, you silly bugger, you're the man. And this time, when I came down, that sense of decision and resolution was with me, and I did go on to write the book on migraine, and I never took amphetamine again. I think this, so in a way, this kick-started me into a sort of writing career, although I think this would have happened anyhow and was just made more dramatic by the drug.
You know, the technology of imaging the brain, I guess, has given us a new way of looking at hallucinations. Uh-huh. And I guess you write about this. I guess they come from different parts of the brain. What do we know about the brain because of all of this?
Well, we know that the brain has many specialized parts, and even, say, in the visual parts of the brain, there are systems for dealing with color, with texture, with motion, with depth, with 30 or 40 other things separately, and then these all get integrated. But now, say, in people with Charles Bonnet syndrome, who may spend hours a day hallucinating, you can perhaps get them into a functional MRI and visualize the brain as they are hallucinating. And you will find, for example, that maybe when a particular, that when they're hallucinating, say, faces, a particular part of the brain called the fusiform face area becomes very active. This area is needed, is in everybody's brain, for recognizing faces. If there's damage to it, you have difficulty recognizing faces. But if it becomes hyperactive, you hallucinate faces. That's actually on the right side of the brain. And on the left side, there's an area which is especially concerned with reading and the recognition of print and musical scores. And that, again, may get overactive. And so you can find a very nice parallel between the sort of hallucination and the part of the brain which is getting overstimulated. How far one can take this is unclear, because, say, the most complex hallucinations are often, you know, hallucinations of the so-called ecstatic hallucinations, or visions of heaven and of angelic voices and visions. But one also has to wonder whether there are some parts of the brain which are can be especially concerned or employed in sort of mystical or religious vision and feeling.
We'll come back to that in a moment. Oliver Sacks is with us. His book is called Hallucinations. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the neurologist Oliver Sacks. We're talking about his latest book. It's called Hallucinations. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's take a call from John, is joining us in Salt Lake City. John, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
So I had a question for your guest. I had a friend who had spent time in jail, and he was under 23-hour lockdown a day, and he spent a couple months there. And he was a completely rational, extremely intelligent individual. And the experience he described to me was that he was fine for a while. He'd spend his days reading and exercising, but at some point, he stopped being able to sleep, and part of that was you know, noise that people were making. It was, you know, kind of an intense environment. And so he stopped being able to sleep at one point, and after that he started having these hallucinations, auditory hallucinations where, you know, sound started to get distorted, like the sound of fans and vents and things like that. And I kind of wanted to ask your guest what he thought about that and the effects of stress, you know, being under lockdown for that much time, and then perhaps the environment and how that can affect the brain, and what the implications are for an individual once that happens, and whether or not it's just exposing a, you know, an underlying issue, or whether the effects of stress manifest themselves and dissipate over time.
Yeah. Oliver Sacks, what do you think?
Well, this is a very interesting and in a way rather frightening story. I can't imagine that being in prison is the nicest experience in the world, and it may be quite terrible if one is in solitary confinement. People in solitary confinement are especially apt to get visual hallucinations. They sometimes speak of prisoner's cinema there. Here, it seems to be the continuation of stress plus sleep deprivation, which push this young man over. Hopefully when, you know, when he gets out of prison or at least sleeps better, this will all settle down. May this happen to anybody? I think so. I mean, to take another most terrible situation of being in a concentration camp. A lot of people broke down at the time or broke down afterwards and had sort of terrible hallucinatory flashbacks of the concentration camp. But some people didn't. Finally, everyone will break down. But some people are more resistant. Incidentally, this is beautifully explored in a film called The Prisoner.
I wanted to ask you about... Thanks, John, by the way. 801-585-WEST is the number. Let's talk about phantom limbs, because this is a fascinating chapter. Phantom limbs, a phenomenon, you say, which is as old as amputation itself. So these are hallucinations, but not quite the same, you say, as hallucinations of sight and sound. These are very particular. You talk about how the phantom takes on a shape and a size, and it's the shape and size of the amputated limb. It's very particular, this hallucination.
Well, in this way, I think a phantom limb is more like a memory. Mm. And it's, as it were, the feeling one has about one's limb and for one's limb persisting when the limb is no longer there. You know, neurologists talk about body image.
Right.
And we all have a body image corresponding to our bodies and their actions. For example, and say with a blind man who uses a stick, in a sense his body image extends to the end of the stick. That becomes almost part of him. But virtually everyone who loses a limb or has it amputated feels it's still there. This is an intensely realistic feeling. It, you know, and it may cause accidents. There are people who've sort of stepped off the curb with a phantom leg and fallen and broken the other leg. Although there must be hundreds of thousands. Well, certainly, you know, now in the States there, I think something like 100,000 amputations a year. And virtually all of these people have phantom limbs to start with. It's odd, however, that this wasn't really described until the 1860s and 70s, mm-hmm. when there were huge casualties in the Civil War. And it was almost as if this was a secret and something not mentioned before. But a phantom limb can be extremely useful. If you're given an artificial leg or prosthesis, then the phantom fits into the prosthesis and it allows you to walk again. The unpleasant thing about phantoms is that sometimes, especially if one doesn't use a prosthesis, the phantom may shrink and get distorted and paralyzed. And, for example, Admiral Lord Nelson, who had an arm shot off, ended up with a feeling of a claw-like hand in which the nails were digging into the palm. Mm. And a colleague of mine, Ramachandran in California, has found a beautiful way of dealing with these distorted, painful, paralyzed limbs. Really by a sort of illusion. He uses a mirror box, and the person puts their good arm, say, in one half of the box, and the brain then mistakes the reflection of the good arm, which can move and is of normal shape, for the phantom.
Yeah.
And it may replace the unpleasant, distorted phantom by the image of a good arm. And it was a brilliant, simple, wonderful idea, and it's made life much easier for thousands of people with phantoms.
I want to play an excerpt from the public radio program Radiolab. You were featured on this particular show as well. You're on that program all the time, which is great. I mean, we're going to hear the program host Robert Krulwich and Ramachandran. Krulwich is explaining here what that device that you were mentioning actually looks like. You know, a mirror, he says, propped up inside a cardboard box.
It was kind of a Home Depot solution, really. Ramachandran took a long and skinny mirror, the kind you'd hang on a closet door.
Right.
And he propped it up using a cardboard box and then turned it sideways. Placed the side right in front of the patient, like right on his nose.
So he couldn't see himself?
No, couldn't see anything in the mirror yet, unless he hooked his neck around and took a peek.
Oh, okay.
Otherwise, he's just looking at the side. Ramachandran says, and I want you to imagine this with me, Jed.
Sure.
He says, I want you to take your good arm, your real arm, okay, and stick it out in front of the mirror. So do that.
Okay.
Now, make it do what the phantom arm does. Take your good arm, make it stiff, curl your hand into a fist, dig your fingernails into your palm deeply. Make it hurt. You doing that?
Yeah, it's kind of hurting.
Okay. Now, when I tell you, crook your head so you can look into the mirror, and on your left, just where the phantom ought to be, let's pretend that that's your phantom arm. It's cramped. It's curled exactly as you'd imagine it. So now look in the mirror.
Okay.
And there's your arm. You see it there in the mirror? Your phantom arm.
Got it.
Now, very slowly, keeping your eye on the mirror now, I want you to curl your hand.
Patient says, okay. He opens his real hand. My God. And of course, it looks like his phantom is opening. That's not surprising. He's got the mirror there. But he says, my God, doctor, you're not going to believe this. The movements have all come back. All these movements in my fingers, in my elbow, in my wrist from 11 years ago come flooding into my mind.
Oliver Sacks, it's so interesting. It seems like so in some ways the mind is kind of resetting the phantom limb.
Absolutely. And, you know, the brain is very plastic and it can learn and unlearn and relearn in ways which can be very destructive but also sort of wonderful.
Mm-hmm. There's another phenomenon you write about called reflex paralysis where the limb is there. It's intact. It's just injured. But the person can't get it to move. You write about this happened to you in that accident we were mentioning, that mountaineering accident, where you say your leg disappeared from your body image.
Yes, well, it not only it can't be moved, but it doesn't seem real.
Yeah.
It's like something inanimate which is attached to you. And this is really the opposite of a phantom limb. Mm. Here you have the limb, but not the phantom. This sort of thing characteristically goes with nerve damage of certain sorts when the brain is not getting the requisite information from the limb, nor can it send commands to move. Mm. I mean, anyone may experience this sort of thing, say, if they have a spinal anesthetic. Mm. If you have that, then it seems that the lower half of the body disappears. You end, say, at the level of your navel or wherever. It is a very, very uncanny experience and difficult to imagine if you haven't had it. In fact, difficult to imagine even if you have had it, because because in general you cannot imagine a hallucination.
You hated this experience.
I did indeed, and I didn't know whether it would ever stop, and I even thought maybe they should chop off the leg. It's just a useless bit of lumber.
Mm.
And curiously, there are people who seem congenitally to lack some of their body image for an arm or a leg or part of an arm or a leg, and in fact badger surgeons to amputate it.
Wow.
These people were all thought of as crazy and psychiatric, but in fact there may be a neurological basis for this. And the opposite can also exist. There may be people who are born congenitally without any limbs, but who still have a good body image.
Yeah.
There's a lovely description of one little girl like this who used her phantom fingers to count. She'd never had any real fingers.
You say that there's a story you tell where a patient threw himself out of bed because he discovered what he thought was his own leg, although it was, though he didn't think it was. He thought it was someone else's, and he trying to throw the leg out of bed because it startled him so much, he threw himself out of bed.
Yeah. I saw this when I was a medical student back in 1959, and it came to my mind very strongly when I had problems with my own leg. But it is very extraordinary how a limb or half one's body may become alien to one. In the same chapter, I also talk a bit about doubles, which again are disturbances of body image. But in the double, you see yourself.
Mm.
Looking just like yourself in a mirror and with all your movements and expressions and postures. And this, as it were, is your body image projected outwards.
Mm.
This can occur in attacks of migraine, and Linnaeus, the great botanist, had this. He'd sometimes see himself walking in the garden, or when he was due to give a lecture, he saw that he was already at the lectern.
Mm.
And he described this with great humour and obviously lived with it and was intrigued by it.
You also write about that sensation that we all feel, that someone is there, someone is behind us or to the right or the left of us. It's like this shadow stalking us.
Yeah, I think this is universal. And we look round and there's no one there, but the illusion is overwhelming. I think especially, say, if we're, you know, coming back along some dark road and we're frightened or anxious. But it may also occur in a positive way. It can occur for Arctic explorers and others who are lonely, who have, as it were, a hallucinatory companion. The hallucinatory companion has always felt to have some intention, either good intentions or maybe not so good intentions. And this sense of a presence, I think, can become almost transcendent.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because you write this, which is really interesting, really provocative in some way. You say this primal sense of the other can take on lofty functions in humans, as this is how you put it, as a biological basis for religious passion and conviction.
Yeah, and I say the presence of the other can become the person of God. Well, here I'm following. I have no patients who have said this, but I'm following William James, who talks about this in the Varieties of Religious Experience. And I think the sense of someone beside one can take on a mystical or religious quality, but there are also other experiences, other hallucinatory experiences, which seem overwhelmingly real. And although I think there are many, many different paths to religion, some of them purely intellectual and some traditional, I think that sometimes visionary experiences of one sort and another are the crucial thing, because they seem inarguably real.
Oliver Sacks. He's a neurologist at New York University School of Medicine, the author of a number of books. His latest is called Hallucinations, and he joined us from a studio in New York. And Dr. Sacks, thank you very much for the time.
Okay, thank you very much.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. Our theme music, composed by The Moth and the Flame. Thanks also to Taylor Almond. Radio West is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.